Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Brainstorm. Today, we have the SpaceX Brain Trust, Tasha, Brett, Daniel, Sam. We got some new information, SpaceX S1, as well as a Starship test flight. Maybe I'll kick it off, just open question to the group. What was the big takeaway from the S1 that maybe wasn't known prior to some of this information coming out? Tasha, we'll start with you and then we'll go round robin.
Sure. And, you know, we wrote about this in the newsletter this week. It seems like the biggest surprise is the $1.25 billion payment to that Anthropic is making to SpaceX per month. This is for the Colossus 1 data center and a portion of Colossus 2. We don't know the exact amount of compute that's for, but overall, like, what does this mean? Well, it shows that, you know, if you think of XAI, right, as a company that's currently kind of like a cash drag on the business, it shows that they can monetize the data center assets, you know, which they have said that they've built in record time compared to industry standard. It also suggests that, you know, they don't need that portion of compute, which is interesting, at least not for now, or they're choosing to rent it out as opposed to use it themselves. You know, a little bit of a sneak peek as to what, like, the future business model could look like for space data centers. You know, here, this is on Earth for now.
Yeah, actually, it's funny because it's going to be a race between, it looked as if prior that connectivity revenue, which is Starlink and Starshield, would be, you know, the bulk of revenue on a forward basis. But now, suddenly, AI is in the race earlier than we expected, in that if they're going to monetize these data center assets on the ground, you know, an annualized $15 billion would put it ahead of current Starlink or connectivity revenue, though if they can commercially launch, you know, a fully reusable rocket, actually, we would anticipate that the connectivity revenue will actually massively accelerate here. And so I would say AI more competitive in terms of its share of top line of the business than we would have guessed.
Sam, Daniel, anything else?
Daniel, you want to go first? You're on mute.
Sure. Sorry. Yeah, I was on mute. That's also representative of the TAM, $28.5 trillion, of which I think $26.5 trillion was AI, and the $1.6 trillion being the connectivity. So really represents the enormous opportunity that AI has. And that breakdown was interesting. I think they called it like the largest TAM of the universe or of the history of companies. So pretty large addressable market for them.
Yeah, and then I think the most interesting of seeing the S1 come out is you finally get to see, it's almost like the playing field is revealed where the bulls and bears are going to line up, right? So prior to this, not so much information, you know, just a lot of people talking past each other. Now I think we're starting to see some real concrete debate taking place. You know, you can look at the revenue per user on Starlink down 18% over the past 3 years. Meanwhile, you know, net income from operations up 840%, but in the last year, just for the first quarter, a greater decrease in revenue per user and less of an uptick. And so bears are picking on that. I think this does come back to a similar story to Tesla, which is the potential for exponential top line growth seems like the biggest debate out there. Right. For Tesla, you have Robotaxi and this potential to really monetize that. For SpaceX, Starship being able to launch a crazy amount of bandwidth into orbit, I think is something that goes underappreciated. And people say, oh, you know, you look at these past years, it's only grown, you know, 10-20% top line growth. You know, what is this? Is this really that important? How are you going to trade at 800 price to sales? And Starship is the answer. Nick, I see your story.
Let me before Nick comes in and tries to pour water on all of it.
No, I just wanted to ask another question, which is how do you square all of these business segments together? Because I think you're right in saying Starship is an unlock. But if you look through the S1, you know, as Daniel pointed out, the majority of the TAM is in B2B SaaS sales, which is, you know, question mark, given it's a space company, but it makes sense because of XAI. So the question to the group is more, how do you square the different business segments? How are they all fitting together in the long term? Tasha, you mentioned space, compute, orbital data centers. That's a part of the story. So how do you think about the next few years and how all of these different segments start to work together?
Wait, can I actually interject and go back to your first question? There was a surprise in the S1, and I'll get to your second question in a second, which was actually the monetization. If you look at our prior published work on SpaceX, monetization of their orbital bandwidth is happening at a higher rate than we had thought. So basically, they're more revenue. You can think of them, they're putting bandwidth in the sky and then they're charging for access to their bandwidth. You know, the work we had done is like, well, this will be fill-in bandwidth for people that don't have good connectivity, but there's clearly large demand from airlines and from governments and stuff that are willing to pay a premium for the bandwidth because it's available where they need it. And so if you raise our curve on our prior published work, you end up with pretty remarkable expectations for bandwidth monetization, even assuming a real pretty steep decay in kind of like their ability to monetize bandwidth based upon Starship's capacity. So a single Starship launch should be able to yield around, for the first 10, $1 billion in incremental bandwidth revenue. And if they can launch the Starship at the Falcon 9 cadence, that over 2 years, that should get their bandwidth revenue to 175-ish billion annually. And so then you ask this question of like, well, how do all these piece together? Having, you know, delivering this amazing rocket gives them the cost advantage that allows them to launch huge chunks of bandwidth at a time, so great ROIC. Actually, to support the bandwidth that they're getting in the sky, they also need to build ground stations to like transmit information up and down. Those ground stations will also be useful for AI compute, and kind of like the low cost of launch allows them to cross a threshold where AI compute can become competitive with terrestrial compute, which leads to an infrastructure as a service business, which you're seeing the evidence of on the ground with their Colossus data center. And then the $28 trillion TAM that Daniel's talking about, that's conditional on them using their compute advantage to deliver kind of a Grok model that's competitive with OpenAI and Anthropic, so that they can get the juicy kind of like token margins rather than just infrastructure as a service margins. And I think that should happen downwind of all of this, or you would anticipate that it'll take time for them to get into that position. There's no guarantee that they get there. So you have this launch business that rose and is launching, successful now, that's leading to a bandwidth business, which also is emerged like this amazing cash flow generative franchise. And that's about to be turbocharged by Starship, leading to, as they launch AI compute, probably an infrastructure as a service business, and the recipe that could deliver them this kind of enterprise software business, though no guarantee.
Well, Brett, what about one abstraction further, which is to say the economy has always been energy based, but there have been many steps between energy and how it's getting calculated into GDP. And with this cycle of AI, there's a tighter loop between energy and output than ever before. And SpaceX AI is going to have the tightest loop and highest capability of scaling energy in the world.
Tasha, yes, Daniel. Or wait. Or you could think of it's like hard energy. The utility of energy has been very locationally sensitive, as in like a part of the problem with very large nuclear power plants is like you need an entire city to require a gigawatt. So in China, they can build very large nuclear plants because they're building entire cities very frequently. In the US, we just need to fill in the margin. So, you know, leaving aside all the red tape and everything else, but also it's like a new gigawatt of power was not something that we were like, hey, we need this. But now kind of with AI, no matter where the gigawatt exists, that can be turned into useful product that can be inexpensively transferred. And so then it opens up space as like a good spot to like find inexpensive energy, because then, you know, it doesn't have to be next to the population center to be useful. And so you can think of AI as taking energy and converting it into useful, transferable product in an frictionless way.
Tasha, Daniel, any other thoughts here?
No, I think that's a good summary, but maybe we can, you know, focus on, okay, as Brett mentioned, a lot of the, you know, the space data center opportunity is really just going to be enabled by declining launch costs, which Daniel and Sam have modeled. For launch costs to really come down dramatically, you know, they need to get Starship to a fully reusable, workable standpoint. So maybe we can talk about the test flight. And Daniel, do you want to kick it off? So, sure. Was it a success? What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, maybe to set the scene why this was so important. So this is the first test of version 3 of Starship. It's their 12th test flight. They completely restructured the ship from previous ones we've seen. It was a lot larger, and this is the ship that they intend to commercialize operations with. Commercialize being deploying the next generation Starlink satellites, both for mobile connectivity and internet connectivity to generate revenue. So whether it was a success or not, I would say it largely was. There was a couple of hiccups in terms of engines not relighting, and the booster in terms of the stage separation didn't work as planned. But all in all, the most important thing is the heat shields for reusability of the upper stage, also called Starship. It's somewhat confusing, the whole thing is Starship, but the upper stage being Starship 2. The heat shields worked as planned. If you look at a comparison I saw on X of the ship coming down versus the last previous two flights, it's a lot more intact. So that's very important for full and rapid reusability. To Tasha's point, that results in declining launch costs. And maybe to put numbers on it for some of the viewers, so SpaceX has cut launch costs by 95% since 2008. It's roughly around below $1,000 per kilogram to launch anything to orbit. We think Starship, because it's reusing both the bottom part and the top part of the rocket, can cut that by another order of magnitude to sub $100 per kilogram. So really, that's what's unlocking this whole concept of orbital data centers. If you read the risk factors section of the S1, albeit a lot of it is boring, but it does have a lot of tidbits in it, and it really flags the importance of Starship for making orbital data centers work. So I would say all in all, it was a success for the most part, and some beautiful imagery too. I got a new phone wallpaper out of some of the pictures they put up on X. So.
And to Daniel's point, it ties in nicely with what Brett said, which is it's pretty easy to see the top line bandwidth revenue curve. That information's out there. And then on the cost side, what does it actually cost to get this in space? You know, Daniel and I have done good Wright's law curve on this, and it's pretty shocking, but for every cumulative doubling of gigabits per second in space, the cost comes down by 44%. So that's an incredibly steep cost decline on the cost side. Meanwhile, you have a lot of high paying customers on the top line side. And so you can see how much potential there is in this type of business to drive all of these other business lines.
What can I pose a question too? I'm curious to get everyone's thoughts. What do we think about the whole concept of getting the lowest cost per token? Because it seems like the pitch from the AI perspective is, well, maybe Grok is slightly behind some of the frontier models. SpaceX is saying, well, we can get energy pretty much free in space, and then eventually vertically integrating through TerraFab will have really cheap hardware, and the combination of those two will overcome the fact that maybe the model isn't the best at the moment. And then once you have the lowest cost per token, it's a positive iterative loop where you're just getting more adoption and the model performance gets better. What are the thoughts on that?
I don't know if adoption accrues to lowest cost per token, but if you think about your cost per token, and also cost per token is not like my favorite metric, because then like there's intelligence density of tokens. Like you can get very low cost tokens that are very dumb right now. Like, you know, you can run a Mac Mini and run a very dumb model continuously, you know, just your cost of electricity. But I think the way to think about the competitive frontier for OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, and SpaceX AI is kind of like how much cumulative resource have you thrown at or how many watts really of compute have you thrown at training? And training can be building new models. It can be taking models that you've built and compressing them so they're very inexpensively deployable and quickly deployable. And there, you know, SpaceX AI remains behind. But if they can get access to inexpensive compute, some of which they're monetizing, some of which they're using for their own internal purposes, then they can use that to catch right up to the frontier. And it's basically like, if you're at the frontier, it seems to be a very lucrative spot to be. If you're slightly behind, kind of like, it's not at all lucrative. And that's the challenge with this market is basically
not only is
like,
it not lucrative, it's very expensive.
Yes, right? Very expensive. It's expensive. And yeah,
the race.
So they do need to catch up in terms of performance to stay in the race. And I think Elon has said he's like, we'll never give up. So they are going to either burn lots of resources to get up to the frontier or burn lots of resources and not get there. And the wager that they will get there is contingent upon a wager that they will be able to access kind of like ginormous amounts of compute more cost efficiently because of their, you know, launch capability.
But the Anthropic deal really de-risks them not being able to deliver on Grok, right?
Yeah.
Because they can spin up these gigantic clusters, and if it doesn't work out with Grok, they can figure out a way to sell this and just become a NeoCloud, which I think is that striking that deal ahead of the IPO probably pushed a lot of the bear thesis out of the story, because I think that was probably one of the major ones going into this, which is they're going to spend a ton of money on compute, and Grok is way behind on frontier adoption and usage.
Right. And they're saying for terrestrial data centers now that their edge is on construction costs, that they think they can do it, you know, multiples cheaper than the competition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tasha, I think that's a
good point. And I mean,
is crazy. It's like they're, I don't know if as part of the video of the launch, right, the bay in which they're going to build and store starships, they're launching skyscrapers into space. Other people are struggling and spending, you know, $17 billion to build the box in which you're going to put computers. I think the construction and logistics team at SpaceX AI is second to none. And that alone is a very interesting optionality for businesses.
Yeah. And that's
where you're going to be deploying, we think, trillions of dollars in capital against compute infrastructure, having the ability to motivate engineering talent to deploy capital just like marginally more efficiently than the competitor. And SpaceX seems to be like much more efficient is its own recipe to print money, because, you know, the marginal pricer of that capital is going to be somebody that tries to make a margin. So if you can sit under them on kind of like your like cost of putting physical infrastructure in place, it can be an extremely attractive business. And this is not going to be a straight. There will be bumps along the road in terms of demand for compute. I think that the elasticity curve stretches out to infinity, but that doesn't mean we're not going to overbuild and underbuild at times. Right now, we're clearly underbuilt. But when there's that kind of like cyclical correction, the person who gets into a lot of trouble is the person who's at the highest part of the cost stack, where they look like they're pricing profitable business and suddenly they're in trouble to their creditors. Whereas if you can be the low cost provider, then you also kind of win on the down cycle as well, because you acquire some of their supply, you basically can become a much more dominant player. So it is a pretty interesting position from that perspective.
What are some of the other risks here? Like, what if Starship
rocket go boom?
Yeah.
Why does this make you sick?
I assume Starship is going to work, but what if it underdelivers? What if they can't get it up to the cadence some have modeled? Like, what are the embedded risks in here when you think further out, maybe 3-5 years?
Well, I mean, the way we model Starship, we model the top stage might not be reusable, or it might not be reusable. One, I think the top stage will definitely be on a different cadence than the bottom stage, as in we model it taking 3 times as long to turn as the bottom stage. And the like reusability in kind of like the meat of our model takes a couple years for the top stage. But the business can still operate quite well, even if the top stage is not reusable, because it's kind of like you have the Falcon 9 top stage not reusable, bottom stage reusable. This provides you with 20x the bandwidth per launch, and it maybe costs, you know, 8 to 10x more to manufacture. We don't know exactly. And so, you know, you get, even if you're still burning off the top stage, you still get a 2x, you know, performance improvement because you're 20x against 10. But once you can reuse both, then you get more like a, you know, a much larger improvement. But I think there will be a period of time where they're probably still trying to figure out how to make the top stage reusable in a rapid way. And the length of that time, it just soaks up cash that they would otherwise be able to re-inject into satellites. And so because the whole business is basically like take cash flow, re-inject it into this great return on capital, take cash flow, re-inject it, you know, you compound at whatever your capital efficiency ratio is. And so if it takes a really long time for the top stage to get reusable, then that slows down the overall rate of growth of the business.
And we should say they do have time because they're the only really company who's making progress in this era. There's one other company that's landed the bottom part of the rocket, the booster, that was Blue Origin. They've reused it once. SpaceX have done it, I think, over 500 times, maybe over 600. So they certainly have time to get it to work. And that's why you have some of the AI hyperscalers and like looking at buying rocket companies, because they potentially see this as the long-term cutting edge. From a differentiation standpoint.
How do you think about Rocket Lab on a relative basis?
So maybe for the viewers, so Rocket Lab currently have a rocket called Electron. It's a small lift rocket. I think it's sub 1,000 kilogram up mass per launch. For context, Falcon 9 is around 23,000. The initial version of Starship will be 100,000, eventually getting to 200,000. And it's currently fully expendable. However, they are working towards a partially reusable rocket, Neutron. And that's very important because it's going to be a lot larger in terms of what you can launch to space, but particularly if SpaceX start to focus on Starship, and it's kind of hinted at the S1 that it's going to start tailing off the Falcon 9 rocket. So it's opening up a large market for someone else to swoop in and take, particularly because they'll not only fill their own demand with Starlink, but not a lot of players have 100,000 or 100,000 kilograms to launch per rocket. So there's definitely like that medium slash heavy launch vehicle market opening up for players like Rocket Lab. But yeah.
Yeah, and I think the way to think about it is that launch is necessary but not sufficient for an amazing space company. Mm-hmm. So you look at Rocket Lab, most of its good business is space services, not just the launch.
Yep.
And then it's like, if you can launch successfully and repeatedly, well, then why are you giving away all that capacity to other people? You start to verticalize and offer some sort of service, which is also what Rocket Lab has hinted at as well. And so it's kind of this constant evolution of, you know, you need to get into the business and you need to be able to launch, but that's not the end business that almost any of these people want to be in.
Yeah. That's why SpaceX is vertically integrating both downstream and upstream, just trying to own the full stack.
I do think at some point, at least as we model it, at some point SpaceX ends up with a lot more launch capacity than they can possibly use internally, even depending on how many ships they send to the moon and Mars. Because, you know, going from a 90-day turn on the top of Starship to like a 30-day turn, suddenly you effectively triple your capacity, and they are rate limited by investing in the satellites, not in kind of like the rockets, I think in most cases. So, you know, the satellites are relatively expensive to fill up the rocket. And so you're spending all of your, you know, money on filling up the satellites, but you're also getting better at launching. So over the medium term, I would not be surprised if there's oversupply in launch capacity.
How much of the
Starship is also so honking large? It's like huge, huge, huge.
How much of the launch capacity today is for Starlink purposes versus third-party satellite?
So I think in orbit, they have something like 75% of maneuverable satellites active today are Starlink. So that kind of gives us some sort of context. So mostly the majority.
Yeah. And in the immediate term, I think they will fill up, like they are governed by launch, filling them up with Starlinks, and then kind of like we'll get launch working, and then, you know, and then they'll be governed by cash they can throw at satellites is the rough sequence that I think you would anticipate. And then in terms of other risks, it's kind of like, can you sign partnerships with enough cellular carriers, or do they run their own cellular network where they're going direct to consumer? That seems like a reasonable play, but there's a lot of execution risk there. You know, what is their customer acquisition cost as they're trying to sell in these dishes? And, you know, we have a nice curve of like monetized bandwidth at this decaying rate, but there's a lot of operational logic that goes into like, we actually have to sign up customers, you know, and so there could be, you know, kind of like, they launch bandwidth and then it takes them longer than we anticipate to actually monetize all of that bandwidth at the rate that they could. But I think it'll probably happen, and it may end up being like Starlink is a cellular provider that you opt for in competition with Verizon or AT&T. And what do you get? You get kind of the same quality of connectivity, but you can get it anywhere. You can get it global, you know, and they're doing that by providing Starlink first, but then having to buy kind of like capacity off of an underutilized urban cellular network along the way. And so that'll have a lot of, you know, call it business strategic partnership risk, whatever that looks like.
What about Tesla? I'm curious to Tasha, Brett, Sam. I'm sorry, I'm throwing a lot of questions out there, but I know we get asked it often.
That's good.
Do we think
everything the acquisition?
Yeah. Like, do we think SpaceX will acquire Tesla? And if so, when do we think is now the right time?
It seems likely that there will be some sort of combination, I would say. I think, Brett, you said in the next couple of years. That makes sense to me. I've been thinking at least within the next 5 years, probably near term, maybe not immediately, as they're doing a lot. They're planning to acquire, or they you know have an option to acquire Cursor. Looks like they probably will soon. So there's a lot of integration there. But it seems like especially with a Terrafab initiative that they've been signaling here.
Speaking of risks, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another one. Yeah. He's going to eat his cheeseburger and smoke a cigar in the clean room.
Yeah. I think from the Tesla shareholder perspective, so long as SpaceX floats and becomes fully unlocked, like all of the shares unlock, and then there's some reasonable time frame for the companies to trade at whatever public market price they're going to trade at that point, kind of like a, you know, there's probably good price discovery to enable a merger to happen in a way that is fair to all shareholders. And you can read, like, the Terrafab is the primary example, but there's lots of kind of like cross commercial ties between the entities that if you have to, you know, approve those across both boards, that's cumbersome and not great from a strategic logic perspective. So I would imagine within a couple of years, it's more likely than not.
Right. They've even said for Robotaxi, you know, they want the XAI models to be the orchestration layer or for any large scale Optimus deployment. But, you know, we have said that the robotaxi business is at a point now where they're really just in the early innings, and we expect that to be very cash flow generative, and, you know, it's not yet at scale. So in terms of, you know, benefiting Tesla shareholders, it'd be great to see more out of that business just in terms of getting closer to scale before the combination.
Yeah, and, you know, I didn't even think about this, but given the potential cash flow generativeness of the robotaxi business, whereas before it's like that model, you couldn't spend it all on like developing Optimus, and so you just had cash accrue. Well, now you actually have a good use for that cash in SpaceX, where you can use it to launch AI satellites. And so, you know, potentially it actually allows them to, you know, as in when you have an opportunity, when you have an amazing ROIC like set of conditions, you want as much capital as possible flowing into that until you basically drive down returns. And with the AI compute side, at least as far as we can tell, there's not a natural mechanism by which that'll get compressed over time. And instead, it's more like there's an urgency to doing it sooner so you can operate at the frontier and monetize at a much better rate than you would as an infrastructure as a service provider. With, like Daniel said, the decade plus advance on any other launch provider they have, they should, you know, maximize the cash they can pump into that business. And so those robotaxi cash flows could become very, very useful. And from a shareholder perspective, you'd rather than that cash sitting there, you'd rather it go into a high ROIC, you know, set of assets. So
you're saying
that there will be plenty of things to throw money at between rockets, AI, data centers, robots. I think they'll find some things. Sorry,
go ahead. Yeah. No, I was just saying. So Brett, you're arguing that it solves this problem for Tesla, that they'll have so much cash and they won't know what to do with it from robotaxi.
Yes. Yes.
You'll need the distributed compute coming off of the Tesla vehicles.
Vehicles. Well. Yeah, that's true.
But before we get to that, maybe we should wrap this episode so we're not. we've been told the YouTube overlords like a 30-minute episode.
Okay.
Well, we're 2 weeks out from the IPO. I think the expected date is June 12th on Trade XYZ. SpaceX is currently listed at $2.4 trillion. So from now until then, we'll find out a lot. I'm sure it won't be quiet, but this is a big discussion. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
ARK Investment Management, LLC, is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public are separate, unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to any company marketing or selling the products or services of the others. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public make no representation or warranties regarding and expressly disclaim any responsibility or liability for any acts, omissions, losses, or damages of the other entities or their affiliates, officers, employees, or agents. No company shall be liable for any indirect, incidental, consequential, or special damages arising out of or in connection with this podcast or its contents. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK, and investors should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statement. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.